All right, so this is Jennifer Blomqvist. I'm here with Judge Gregory A. Adams. It's the last day of February 2022, February 28th. And Judge Adams, thanks again for meeting with me and allowing us to record your oral history for our archives. And I'd like to ask you to begin just to talk about your childhood, your upbringing, schooling, and we'll start there.
Oh, sure. I am originally from Atlanta. I grew up in the Kirkwood area, which is in the city of Atlanta, DeKalb County. I attended Kirkwood Elementary School, Corn Middle School, and I graduated from Murphy High School. I'm very proud to say I completed my education in the Atlanta public school system. From there, I graduated from Georgia State University. I majored in criminal justice. From there, I went to and graduated from the University of Georgia in Athens, and I received my JD degree from the University of Georgia in Athens. I decided many years ago, probably when I was in the sixth grade, that I wanted to become a lawyer. And one of the reasons I decided to become a lawyer because I was inspired by an individual who I'd never met. However, I was highly motivated by the career of Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, at one point, was a lawyer with the NAACP. He later became the Solicitor General and later became the first African-American to be on the United States Supreme Court. And Thurgood Marshall, obviously, is much older than I am. He's since passed away. But watching his career and the things that he was involved in, I realized the power of a lawyer. They can help others and change people's lives. So that's what motivated me to become a lawyer. But also, I not only just want to become a lawyer, also, in particular, I want to become a prosecutor, because that's really is the most powerful person in the courtroom, because it is the prosecutor who makes the decision as far as what charges will be brought against an individual, and if those charges will, at the appropriate time, be presented to a jury and or a grand jury. So, really, the most important, the most powerful person in the courtroom is the prosecutor. So, after graduating from law school, I came back to the Atlanta area. Matter of fact, I had been offered a job to be with this law firm, but I later ended up taking a job with the DeKalb County Solicitor's Office. I was a prosecutor in the DeKalb County Solicitor's Office for 3 years. After serving 3 years in that capacity, I later went on and joined the DeKalb County District Attorney's Office. I was an assistant district attorney. I rose all the way up to the deputy chief district attorney. Also, I was the special prosecutor at the time, handling the more complex murder cases and multiple rapes and multiple armed robberies, those type of cases. And then an opening came about in the DeKalb County Juvenile Court, and individuals recommended that I apply for that particular position. As you may or may not be aware, juvenile court judges are appointed by the sitting elected Superior Court judges. Uh-huh. And I was among, I think it was at least 28 other lawyers who applied for that opening. I was the youngest one at that time. I made it to the short list. And I interviewed with the Superior Court judges. And Judge Siliger was one of those judges in the Superior Court. Mm. And I was appointed as the juvenile court judge. Mm. After doing 7 years in the DA's office.
7 years.
I spent 3 years in the solicitor's office, 7 years in the DA's office. And I came out of law school in 1984, and I became a juvenile court judge in 1994. And I was juvenile court judge for 10 years, and then I ran for an open seat, and I was elected in 2004 and became a Superior Court judge January 1st, 2005.
Was there anything in particular about the juvenile justice system that drew you to that position, that drew you to that judge?
Oh, that's a great question. What had taken place, I had been a prosecutor for 10 years, and near the latter part of my career as an assistant DA, I pretty much only handled cases that involved people who had murdered individuals, multiple murders at that. The real aggravated cases. And I got to the point and I realized there has to be a better way. So you have to get involved with people at an earlier stage to make a difference in their lives. So when the opportunity came about to go over to the juvenile court system, see, the juvenile court system, unlike the adult system where I am now, the juvenile court is designed for treatment and rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. I've been a prosecutor my entire career up to that point. And I realized if I really wanted to make a greater impact in this community, I needed to see if I could reach younger people. Mm. And to deter them from coming in or progressing or being promoted to the adult system. Mm-hmm. So by going to the juvenile court system, it allowed me to interact with younger people, try to divert them out of the system. Well, once they come in, you don't want them to stay in forever. So we were very fortunate. The 10 years I was at the juvenile court, we were very creative and we were able to get a lot of grant money. Matter of fact, millions of dollars in grant money, and we used that for treatment and rehabilitation. Matter of fact, we had raised the most money in grant in the history of DeKalb County for the juvenile court. And that's one of the reasons we started doing things a little differently, because we were successful at obtaining federal and state grants for treatment and rehabilitation. And we put those in programs. Now, some people take the position you only should put money in programs that are tried and true. That was not my approach. My approach is you never know what will be successful with a person. Therefore, I was willing to invest funds into programs that did not have a track record. But those individuals had a vision on what they may be able to do to help young people. So we took chances. Mm-hmm. And some of those chances were successful in allowing those young people to go into some of those programs and as a result to make better choices. Now, there's no guaranteed results. I don't care if it's an established program or a new program. It still is left up to that individual to make a change. Mm-hmm. But different strokes for different folks. I mean, some things work for this children, some work for that child, mm-hmm. some things work for that child. And you just have to try different things. And sometimes we were successful. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna sit there and tell you we changed the world. No, but we changed some people.
Absolutely.
Gave them a different outcome than what they would have had we not invested into some of those new startup programs.
Do you have any success stories in mind? Anything that stands out to you in terms of your work in the juvenile court and those programs that you helped get funded?
Yeah, I understand. And some of it is going to be anecdotal. I mean, because you didn't track. Well, let me make sure we're clear before I give you this response. Yes, the programs were tracked and they're data driven. That is true. But I did not keep independent notes.
Sure.
Now, but success stories, this is what I base it upon. The great thing about when you're dealing with juveniles, for one, all the hearings are confidential, and therefore it's not in the newspaper. And those individuals who are in my court system, or were in my court system, they know they were there. Their parents will know. I mean, obviously the witnesses will know, but the general public a lot of times don't know. So sometimes I'm out in the greater community. I'll give you one real life example. It was years after I'd been a juvenile court judge. I was at a Piccadilly or Memorial Drive. It's no longer in business. I'm standing in line, and I'm behind this couple, and this gentleman, young person, he turns around to me. He said, "Are you Judge Adams?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "You don't remember me," which I did not. He said, "Let me introduce you to, this is my wife." He had been to the juvenile court for doing something. He had since graduated from high school, went into the military, gotten married, and turned his life around. Now, when you say, yes, it's anecdotal, but yes, that is a real life success story. That happens to me even now, probably about maybe once a year, in which I will see a person who's much younger than me. I don't recognize them. I don't know them. But because I'm the only judge, I'm the person wearing the black robe, they remember who was their judge. And they will come up and tell me that they went through programs so on and so, and it helped them. Yes, I have those type of stories that say, yes, we made a difference. So, yes, there are real life people in which we made differences for in their lives. And since the juvenile court is confidential because technically they're not found guilty, they could be adjudicated delinquent and or deprived and put in, you know, state's custody. And some of those have successfully was in state care, successfully, you know, came out of state's care, went on to college, technical school, or just got a job, and they're just trying to make their way in life. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we have success stories on both sides, the delinquent side and the deprivation side. Mm-hmm.
And do you have recollection, or do you remember your thought process when you were deciding to go from juvenile court to running for superior court?
Oh, I can tell you. I always knew that I was going to come back to the adult system at some point in time.
Okay.
Because that's where I started, in the adult system. I knew I wanted to be in the adult system. And at some point, after 10 years of, in my mind, total commitment, it was time for a change. I had done what I could do. Plus, the other issue, I mean, the big problem was when I first became a juvenile court judge, we were in a dilapidated, rundown facility that I inherited. The county had built that building 30 years before, and unfortunately, the DeKalb County is not any different from a lot of other counties. They don't do well in maintaining buildings.
Mm.
Because, and this is what I use as real-life example. See, commissioners and politicians, they don't mind standing in front of a camera cutting a ribbon for a new building, but nobody, taxpayers don't give you credit for maintaining an existing building. You can't come out once a year and say, oh, we've maintained this structure. There's no leaks. There's no, the plumbing works. No. Taxpayers don't want to hear that. They just want to say, what are you doing? What have you done for me lately? Mm-hmm. So most a lot of governments do not maintain their buildings very well. Mm-hmm. So I inherited a building that had a leaking roof to the point whereas when it was raining when I was in that building and I would go into the restroom because the judges had their own restroom, I would have to literally hold an umbrella over my head because water would be dripping on my head in the restroom because my office was on the third floor and it was only a three-floor building, running water. The building, I would routine, my staff would tell me that rodents were running through the building because the old juvenile court was constructed and built on an old landfill. And as a result, the building early on was sinking, had cracks, methane gas was coming up. Plus, because it was built on a landfill, which was garbage, rodents lived in the landfill. Simply because you put a building on top of it, the rodents that live underground are still there because they're still living off of the trash and debris that's compacted in the ground. So that was their home turf. And because of lack of maintenance in the building, my staff would routinely report to me, not just the dripping water when it was raining, but the rodents running through the building, the methane gas, you know, mm-hmm. in the building, those type of things. And it was just deplorable. And when we started the request or the campaign to get a new building constructed, I would have to come downtown. We'd take pictures and photographs and present them to the county commissioners. And the concept is pretty simple. If you're bringing children into this court system and this building is literally falling down around them, it looks like the adults, myself included, and the commissioners and all the taxpayers, we don't care about them. So mm-hmm. how can you convince a young person to listen to us as adults that we're trying to help you and we are have you go to a dilapidated, rundown building? It didn't make sense. So that was part of the presentation. If we really want to help these children, and politicians say that's what they want to do, mm-hmm. help children, in quotes and quotes, mm-hmm. we got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so it took almost 10 years of working with different CEOs, different county commissioners, and they finally were convinced that they needed to invest in building a new building. And they finally built one. But it took 10 years of making requests, documenting. Matter of fact, we had to bring out the grand jury because one of the roles of a grand jury, because only I knew because I was a former prosecutor and I would work with the grand jury, their charge is they have to inspect county buildings annually. And they do it as a subcommittee. So we would invite them out to inspect the building. And they would write up report after report how horrible the DeKalb County Juvenile Court was, how it needed to be repaired, it needed to be A, B, and C. So that was part of the presentation also of getting a grand jury involved who represents the conscience of the citizens. But the point was very simple. You can't have a deplorable building and try to convince these children we're trying to help them and it's in their best interest. So.
Is that the building that's on Memorial that was named in your honor?
That is correct.
That is correct.
That is correct.
And so that building is nice and shiny and new.
That's correct. And I hope, because I've never worked in that building.
Right.
And I did not know they were going to name the building after me. That was not part of my, I was doing it because it was in the best interest of those children to have a decent facility. They named the building after I had left and I was down here in Superior Court. But that was not part of the presentation. It wasn't about me. It really was, and it still isn't. It was about those children. I never worked in the building. I never had office space in the building. It was about the children who I knew would come after me. You can't say you want to help people if you don't do the right thing by them.
Sure.
So, but yes, it is on Memorial Drive.
Yes. Well, I asked you about a particular case or person in your juvenile court career. Is there a particular case, and I know I don't expect you to name names, but is there a particular case in your Superior Court time or your time as a prosecutor that stand out to you as just memorable or interesting or weird in some way, something?
Well, I understand what you're saying. You know, I have several cases that I think about. When I was a prosecutor, it was a homicide case in which a young lady was murdered by her then boyfriend who was married to someone else. And he had come up with this idea that he was going to commit the perfect crime. He was going to murder her, go out to Jackson Hartsfield Airport, catch a flight, fly to a meeting that he had scheduled in the Bahamas, and that was going to be his alibi. And The problem was, unlike on TV, things don't always go as planned because the victim was fighting and she fought for her life and she was able to scratch him and they were able to link him to the crime by the DNA. Plus, because of the prolonged fight, he missed his flight. And so his plan sort of got changed. But that wasn't the reason it's memorable because one of the victim's sister, because they sat through the whole trial and they realized it was really a circumstantial evidence case. But because, and we were successful, I mean, I was the lead lawyer on the prosecution team and we were able to have this gentleman found guilty. But as a result of that, one of the victim's sister, she would send me a Christmas card every year. And then on the anniversary of her sister's death, she would give me a call just to thank me for standing up for their family. Mm-hmm. So that's one of those ones in which it's memorable from the standpoint that mm-hmm. we come into the courthouse, we're doing our job, but all these cases impact people's lives. And to this day, this citizen, she still will contact me and let me know how her nephew's doing, how she's doing. And this is, I've been a judge now for this is my 28th year as a judge. And I prosecuted that case. It was over 30 years ago. And she still, matter of fact, ironically, she called me last year around Christmas time just to check and see how I was doing and just to tell me how she's doing. She's since retired from the workforce, although I'm still working. But just to stay in contact. And she still, and she, like I said, now I do not have an independent recollection of the date her sister passed away. Because I just handled a lot of cases, but she did. But it made an impact. The point is, we come into these jobs, and I tell new lawyers it's the same. These are people's lives, and they remember. The decedent is dead, but it's how do you deal with the family? Do you respect the family, listen to them, and keep them informed of the process? Because any trial, people always think you're always going to win. That's not the case, especially if there's, and this is, most of my cases were tried pre-DNA. DNA was just coming along in the latter part, but a lot of this is pre-DNA, mm-hmm. pre a lot of the scientific evidence, mm-hmm. pre the TV shows that people think you can get a fingerprint off everything. That's not the real world. So, and that's just one. There are others in my brain sure. that will come to me as time goes on. But yes.
Well, speaking of memorable things, we've all been living through COVID for the last couple of years. How has your job, how has the court been handling COVID since it's...
Well, that's a great question. Now, COVID has definitely turned the court system on its head from the standpoint, before COVID, 100% of our hearings were in person, mm-hmm. in a courtroom, all the time. I mean, we were in court 5 days a week, 52 weeks out of the year, all in person. COVID hit as a result of COVID, because especially early on before the vaccine came along, before people knew how it was spread, we could not have face-to-face hearings. And I do have to give some kudos to the clerk of Superior Court. Unrelated to COVID, years before, she had went to the county commissioner and convinced them to invest in the Odyssey system, which is a computer system that is very robust. It allows documents to be scan directly into the system. It allows us to put our signatures into the system remotely. It allows us to work remotely and interface with the county system. But in the county, spent millions of dollars buying that system. Now, nobody knew COVID was going to come. But because the clerk of Superior Court had led us to the Odyssey program, we were uniquely situated that the county had a system, but the clerk of Superior Court had a system in place that was paid for by the county to handle documents remotely. Also, because not only because of the clerk of Superior Court, but because of the Odyssey system, we had started acquiring more laptops so that we could do things remotely. And we weren't really using it remotely because there was no need. Then all of a sudden, COVID hit. And then the foundation of the software was there already and the hardware was supported. Plus, we had to add some additional laptop computers, and we were able to get up fairly quickly. And the county, it's a pretty wealthy county from the standpoint. They have money to buy the equipment. They had the money to buy additional laptops and hardware and software to support what we needed. And so as a result, we didn't miss a beat. Because now, we all had to get used to seeing people. It's good to see you in three dimension. Because I was doing remote hearings this morning. We're still doing remote hearings, also a combination in court and out of court. Now today I'm doing remote hearings. On Thursday I'll be doing in person because it's criminal. Now the criminal case is a little different because an accused has a legal right to confront their accuser. the defense lawyers and the prosecutor, they did not want to waive the confrontation clause, and so they wanted to be in the same room with the witness. So as a result of that, a lot of the criminal hearings were delayed if testimony was going to be taken. Now, if a person wants to waive their right to be present and they want to enter a plea to resolve the case, we were able to accommodate that. Mm-hmm. But if there was a motion to suppress or any other question about identity, and we had to take testimony, unless the defense lawyer and the defendant agreed to waive the person-to-person, we had to do it remote. We had to wait. Yeah. Now, tomorrow will be 24 months. I mean, we suspended in-person hearings, I think it was March the 12th of 2020. So we went all of 2020, all of 21. So, in 12 days, it'll be exactly 24 months when we suspended all. Because matter of fact, we were right in the middle of a hearing. We were scheduled to start a jury trial that next week. And we were taking a pleas on that Friday. The word came down from the Georgia Supreme Court that this is pre-vaccination. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to suspend it because people were getting sick. Mm-hmm. And back then, people are still dying, but they were dying at a higher rate. Right. And no one knew how it was transmitted. Because remember, they tell you to wash your hands. But at first, wear gloves, social distancing, wipe down the seat countertops. But we didn't know how it was transmitted. So it really slowed us down on the criminal side. Now, the civil lawyers adapted a lot quicker because on the civil side, there's no right to confront a witness. I mean, you question a witness, but they were willing more liberally because you're fighting over money to waive the face-to-face and do it remotely. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the civil lawyers were used to doing recorded and video depositions already. Mm-hmm. So questioning witnesses over a video, because sometimes the expert may be in California, the case here in Georgia, instead of flying a person here, they'll sit down at a video camera and do video depositions. So they were used to. Mm-hmm. And so the civil bar adapted a lot quicker than the criminal bar, which is okay, and I understand. So And so it slowed down a little bit. Now it slowed down more on the criminal side than the civil, but the civil cases are really humming along. Now, we have had not as many jury trials, because even though we suspended jury trials, and we started jury trials back last May, and so they were technically suspended for 15 months, almost throughout the whole state, well, really throughout the whole state and country. Then we started gradually having more jury trials, but we were not having as many. There are 10 Superior Court judges. It was a time all 10 of us could be on trial at one time. We can't do that right now. So we modified. At one point, we were doing one jury trial for Superior Court. Now we're doing two jury trials per floor. Mm-hmm. We're still not fully operational, but even we start and stop. Our circuit had 33 jury trials from May until December of last year. In January of this year, we suspended jury trials again because there was a surge in the new coronavirus. I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but it came back. And then as a result, to be protected for citizens, we suspended jury trials again. No, we were still having remote hearings. We're still all having them. So we're having more of a hybrid. Mm. Like today, I had civil case, I had divorces, contract disputes, and we did it all remote. Mm. No one came in. Well, the courtroom is open because by law I have to get the courtroom open. I had a deputy in there, and I'm broadcasting into the courtroom, but everyone else is remote. Hmm. And right before you came, I was on a Zoom hearing finishing up some child custody cases remote.
You're very busy, and I just have a couple more questions.
Sure.
So I saw in your bio on the website that features your page and all your contact information that you served by designation on a Supreme Court case. Can you talk a little bit about what that case was about?
Yes. I know you're right. As a matter of fact, that photograph up there is when I served on the Supreme Court. They were nice enough to take a picture when I was just sitting on that one particular case.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, in that case involved a murder case, and it was a death penalty case in which they were trying to basically get the death penalty overturned.
Mm.
I sat in the majority, for lack of a better term, affirm the lower court and allow that sentence to stand.
Okay.
But normally, I mean, what they do, say for instance, if a Supreme Court justice has a conflict, and in this particular case, I think it was Justice Nomulus, he had just gotten on the Georgia Supreme Court, and his wife worked at a firm who was representing the accused on the appeal. And so since his wife worked for that firm, he recused himself. He didn't know about the case personally, but just so it would not have the appearance of impropriety, he recused himself. And as a result, I sat, and back then there were only 7 members of the Georgia Supreme Court, and I sat as one of the justices for that case.
And did they contact you? How does that work?
Oh, great question. Great question. Yeah. The way that works, the sitting justices, they will pick from Superior Court judges from around the state, and they have a list. Uh-huh. And yes, they made contact with me and asked me would I be willing to sit. Now, the first time they gave me an opportunity to sit, I had a conflict because I was on my own jury trial, and I couldn't sit. And then the next time, they said, okay, we need you to come and deal with this issue. And I agreed. And they gave me all the case material, all the briefs. I read them before. I drive downtown. I sit for oral argument. I participate in the discussion. And I participate in the vote. But yes, they invite you. And but it's by invitation only by the sitting members of the Georgia Supreme Court. Wow. And they normally will, you know, I'm very fortunate because every Superior Court judge has not sat on the Georgia Supreme Court when they have a conflict. So I'm very fortunate. Matter of fact, a lot of Superior Court judges don't get that opportunity. And normally it's based upon your reputation with them as whether or not they think you should be eligible to sit on one of their cases.
And how does one become a Supreme Court judge?
Oh, great question. I can tell you that. I'm not a Supreme Court judge, but you get to the bench in Georgia one of two ways. Either you run for an open or you run for a seat, or you get appointed by the governor and you still have to run. Now, they're currently, they put it in perspective, they're currently, because under Governor Deal, they expanded the Georgia Supreme Court. They went from 7 justices to 9. Out of the 9 justices on the Georgia Supreme Court today, only one of them actually ran and won an open seat. The other 8 were originally got there by appointment. Now, they later got, you know, were re-elected, were elected and kept the seat or retained. But only one, that's Justice Ellington, he's the only one right now who ran for an open, who ran because Justice Sunstein, who came out of DeKalb County, announced her retirement and it went to an election. Justice Ellington, or Judge Ellington, he was on the Court of Appeals, announced he was going to run for her seat. He ran and he won. So out of the 9 people on the Georgia Supreme Court right now, only one was elected by the voters. On the Georgia Court of Appeals, there are 15 judges on the Georgia Court of Appeals. Out of the 15 judges right now on the Georgia Court of Appeals, only 3 of them ran and won their seats. The other 12 were initially appointed by the governor and retained. Okay. Now, and like I say, I'm an elected judge. I mean, I ran for an open seat, and I was elected by the voters. I was not initially appointed, but you get either you get appointed by the governor and then run for election, or you can run. And you can challenge an incumbent and win, but I ran for an open seat, and I won. But I was put here not by a governor, but by the citizens of this great county, DeKalb.
And do you have to... You're in office until...
I have to run every 4 years.
You have to run every four years.
Every 4 years. Matter of fact, I will be running again in 2024. But every 4 years, I have to pay a qualifying fee if I want to keep this seat and run for office.
Gotcha.
So no, it's an elected position.
So last question. I imagine that being a prosecutor, being an attorney, being a judge, as long as you've been doing it, probably has stresses.
It does.
And it's... I'm wondering one thing that you do to help you unwind from a tough day at the office.
Oh, I understand. I know. I understand. Let me respond this way. Because, no, it is a very stressful career and job.
Yeah.
Everyone, and I tell new judges this all, you have to have an outlet. Now, my outlet, I don't do it every day. My outlet, I like to play golf. And the reason I play golf, because I'm a recreational golfer. I'm not on the PGA Tour. I'm never going to be on the PGA Tour. That's not my skill set. That's not the objective. Some people say, well, I mean, golf is frustrating. Well, it is, but see, the reality is this. If I hit the ball into the woods, it doesn't hurt anybody. If I hit the ball into the water, it doesn't hurt anybody. It's nothing but a lost ball and a stroke penalty. It's okay. So I can make mistakes on a golf course, and there's no ramifications that are meaningful. It's just a score on a scorecard. If I lose my focus here and I don't do what I need to do, people can be hurt or injured. I can destroy a family when I should not be destroying a family. So I use golf as a way to be in an environment in which I can make all the mistakes I want and need and release that stress. That's what I use for. Plus, you're hitting a golf ball, and sometimes you can imagine, for lack of a better term, take out your frustration, you hit the ball, and it gets it out of your system. I walk on a regular, and I do that on a daily basis. I walk to release tension and stress. I use that to release, but my primary outside recreation is playing golf, and I walk in a form of exercise.
Do you have a favorite golf course?
Ooh.
Or a dream golf course you haven't played yet?
Well, there's a golf course I really enjoyed. It's down in Florida. I think it's called Sawgrass. That's I have played that once and I enjoyed it. Now you said a dream golf course. Now I would love for someone to invite me to play Augusta National. So I've never played Augusta National. Matter of fact, I've never even been to Augusta National. I've watched the Masters on TV, but I would love whoever's listening to this to invite me to, about to ask for a solicitation. But if someone wants to, but that's a dream golf course to play, Augusta National. I've had the opportunity. Now the PGA, which is the Professional Golf Association, they play an annual tournament over at East Lake Country Club. Uh-huh. I've played there a number of times. I like that golf course. It's a very nice golf course. Obviously, I'm not playing at the same length or skill level as the pros, but it is unique to play a course that you watch on TV and you see the pro. But East Lake is a great golf course. I've played that, and it's fun. It really is. You know, you walk the course, and you're not a pro. You don't hit the same kind of shots. Mm. There's nobody clapping and nobody booing either when you hit the ball. That pressure, I don't understand. Those guys can really, that's real concentration. To have hundreds and sometimes thousands of people watching everything you do and to be able to focus on hitting that golf ball, that's real stress. But no, I enjoy playing East Lake. I would love to play Augusta National. But there are, man, hundreds and hundreds of golf courses. But I enjoy just playing recreational golf.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'll end the recording there.
No problem.